Before we get started, I just want to apologize to you guys in advance. This mic was not on during this recording with Connor, so as we roll into this, just bear with me. My camera picked up the audio, so we're just going to roll with it. A lot of really good in-depth conversation, so forgive me. Next time I'll do better. So let's get on with it.
Swing the high drive! Speaking of... Jackson Holiday,
welcome to Touch of Baseball Podcast. See your beautiful smiling faces again. Today I have another guest on for Baseball Chaos, and we're talking Orioles, which has been a team that, let's just say, been a little bit quiet this offseason. Everybody's thrown off, but, you know, we're kind of used to that as Mariner fans. Today joining me is Connor Newcomb with Locked On Orioles. So we're talking a little bit in depth about the trades they've made, the, I would say, free agent international signing that they made that I didn't see coming, and just the little things of how their team could get better as we loom only 1 month away. Connor, thank you for joining me. If you guys want to check him out, go check out the links down in the description. We'll have it down below. Orioles, we'll start with the one thing. Tyler O'Neill signed. So... you lost a big bat with Anthony Santander. You gained a big bat with Tyler O'Neill. I've been talking about this quite a bit. You guys are changing your wall again. Well, hey, luckily he's a right-handed bat, and that might work in his favor. Do you think there's a correlation there just before we dig into anything too crazy? Like, they're moving the wall. Let's go sign Tyler O'Neill.
Yeah, Tyler O'Neill knows the wall a bit because he was in Boston this year. Now he was... hurt so much of the season that he didn't play, you know, as many games as he could have at Oriole Park. And obviously being with St. Louis, I don't know if he ever played at Oriole Park with the Cardinals, but he, I think, mentioned it in his presser after signing with the Orioles. So it's a piece of the equation. The Orioles were going to move it either way. Now they were, it kind of works out because they were targeting a right-handed bat and they were moving the wall. It's not necessarily 100% correlated. Some of it had more to do with their current right-handed hitters on the team and helping them out a little bit, and just realizing that they may have gone too heavy the last time. And I think we could, like, you can agree they went too heavy, right? They shot the wall up in the air to 30 feet. They pushed it back another 30 some feet. Like, that was a lot to do. Yeah. I'm kind of sad they're moving it just because I enjoy that major league ballparks can be gimmicky and there aren't standard dimensions for every park. So I liked when Aaron Judge would get angry and say it to the media about, you know, the Orioles Mickey Mouse ballpark and whatever it is and how he can't hit home runs out there. I found that to be funny. It was also kind of nice because the change in the wall came in 2022 and that went immediately in line with the Orioles playing good baseball again and coming out of the rebuild. And their pitching has been behind their hitting talent-wise the entire time. So it's kind of helped them. Now that they had their first real offensive struggles as a team since they really turned things around, I'm not sure how much that went into it either, but it felt like timing-wise, if you were going to go back on it, this was a nice time to kind of do that. And luckily, they're not moving it all the way in because it was a disaster the other way in 2021 and previously. It was a wall that was 6 feet tall. It was 350 feet out there. It was home runs galore for right-handed hitters. So I'm hoping this year will be a happy medium. I'm sure Tyler O'Neill is happy that he'll be able to hit a few more home runs in his home games. And it all depends, right? He has an opt-out after the first year. So if he opts out after 1 year, it doesn't really affect him that much. If he stays for 3 years and, you know, really has to rack up some stats before his next contract, maybe that helps him out a little bit more. But I think a little bit of correlation, not a lot of it, for the decision they made with the wall.
More coincidental more than anything. I think that was my favorite meme, by the way, that like 6 out of 30 ballparks, this would be a home run, or 6 out of 30, you know, ballparks, that would be a foul ball. Just they popped up everywhere as soon as that happened. Remember that was at the very beginning of the year. So, yeah. And I mean, the fact that he does have an option next year, that's kind of like a double-edged sword though. Cause like, for the Orioles, it's more of like a safe haven because if he doesn't perform well, he doesn't want to play there. But at the same time, it's like, all right, you didn't perform well. You sure you want to go back on free agency? And then that could be the Orioles like, we're stuck with him because he doesn't want to, you know, leave if he does really bad. So I can see where that could be scary, I guess, for depending how he does. I think he's going to do fine because I heard that there was going to be like a 6 foot to 20 foot difference that they're bringing the wall in. So that's pretty major. Because how deep is it in that corner by the bird bath? Am I saying that right? Is that the section?
Yeah. So in the corner at the bird bath, before it was 398 with a 30-foot wall. So it felt almost impossible to hit home runs there. And that's going to come in more to the 380-ish mark. And the wall's going to come down. So their goal is for it to play like a neutral park. It was super hitter friendly. They turned it into extremely pitcher friendly. They're trying to find a happy medium.
I'm kind of curious. I wanted to look this up. I should have looked it up before, but the far left center field of Fenway. Obviously, the Green Monster's way taller, but that farthest corner before it turns. I'm. Do you know offhand like how deep that is in comparison? Just for reference?
I do not.
I don't either. It makes me. I really do want to look it up, and I thought I'd be able to pull it up, but I guess I'm not fast enough.
That Fenway, the Fenway left field alley, it looks like is 379, like back in the corner where the monster juts into center field. That's 379, and then the weird cutout in right center field in Fenway is 420, the one that like feels like it's a mile away.
Okay, yeah.
Per Google search.
Yeah. And then I guess the farthest point would be that, yeah, like we were saying, that far. That right center, it's almost dead center to the right side, a little niche. It's such a weird shaped park that they have over there. I mean, cool. It's great. It was great for Tyler O'Neill. I think that worked out in the long run. But that dude's jacked, by the way. Holy crap.
Yes.
We'll see how he does. But I also did look up because you mentioned his time actually playing in Oriole Park, which it turns out he never played when he was with the Cardinals in Baltimore, and then he only played this last season when he was with Boston for 4 games. So very small sample size of how well he'll hit there, even though they are changing those dimensions, which is interesting to look at. So it is very much like a kind of a wild card at this point. But with that said, I mean, this kind of runs into pitching is the kind of the other side. Cause I know that pitching has been since Burns left, obviously surprisingly signed with Arizona. It's 2020 hindsight. It's like, oh, of course he lives there. I didn't expect that. I really had no clue that the Diamondbacks would be signing him for especially the length of contract, 6 years. So it's pretty much his final decision, unless he decides the Max Scherzer and extend it through 40. But with him gone and then having Sugano, and I forgot how to say his first name, so forgive me, YouTube, because I should have it in front of me. But out of nowhere signing, and basically what, Japan's Max Scherzer, Justin Verlander, but still performing. I mean, I think it's a great pickup. Am I a little bit worried because of the type of ball he's going to be throwing, his age, the level of hitting he's going to go up against, and then, of course, like we're talking about that left field getting pulled in? Yeah, I'm a little concerned. But is that something that Orioles fans are talking about or concerned about, or are they just ecstatic that they got someone at this caliber, even if it's in the MPB?
Yeah, I think there's definitely some concern. Most of it probably comes from the fact that he's 35 and you're not getting, you know, I think the biggest thing that circulated after the Orioles made the signing was his highlights from the WBC in 2017 when he was like mowing through that Team USA order of all the Major League All-Stars. It was like, yeah, that's great. That was almost 8 years ago when that happened. So, you know, you're looking at a very different pitcher. You were looking at a guy who was in his prime at 27 and was throwing 95, 96. His off-speed stuff is still as good. He's just 92 now, and he doesn't get as many strikeouts, and he has to hunt soft contact a little bit more. So he is a different pitcher than he was 8 years ago, but I don't think that's like a knock on him, because pretty much every pitcher is different than they were 8 years ago if they've been pitching professionally that long. Like, you lose velocity, you change the way you throw. Like, it happens to everybody. There's a little worry as well, I think, about the fact that he did not sign when he was posted the last time. So this was not a posting. This was him just being a free agent and him being able to sign wherever. He was posted by his team, the Yomiuri Giants, after 2020, which was the last time he won the MVP in Japan before this year. And the Giants offered him 4 years, $40 million to come back to Japan and basically said, hey, if you get a better deal in MLB, go for it. If not, here's 4 years, $40 million. And he did not get a better deal from a major league team, which is why he came back. And that's when he was 31 and was throwing harder and had just come off an MVP season over in Japan. So you worry about, you know, what was the evaluation? Obviously, it was during the COVID season, so money was a little tighter for teams. So that is obvious. And of course, moving from Japan to the U.S. during COVID was a much heavier lift for everybody involved. So those were certainly factors that came into play. And Sugano talked about those factors in his introductory press conference with Baltimore a couple weeks ago. But I think at the end of the day, like, you get a guy who walked 2% of batters this year in Japan. You get a guy who is not going to give up the big inning. But the question is, what is the ceiling at this point? Yes, the strikeout rate is around 18%. That's pretty low. That's below big league average. A lot of good NPB pitchers actually get higher strikeout rates when they come to MLB because although the ball is different, the hitter approach is so different. It is a much more contact-oriented approach in Japan, whereas a lot more major league hitters in the U.S. are just more okay with swing and missing because they're selling out for power a lot more. So sometimes that leads to a little uptick in K rate. But even if he gets an uptick, he's still, you know, league average strikeout wise at best. So you are relying on contact. And when you throw 92 and when you're 35, that can sometimes lead to some home runs and can get you into trouble. So he's going to have to be that finesse pitcher on the corners, which is what he's been in Japan for years and years. But can he continue to do it? But on the flip side, 1 year, $13 million. There is no such thing as a bad 1 year deal. If it goes poorly, it goes poorly, and you don't even have to keep him around for the full year. You can put him in the bullpen, cut him loose, whatever you want to. Like, you're not banking everything on Sugano. Right now on the depth chart, he's the Orioles' number four starter. So it's not like they're putting all the eggs in the Sugano basket right now. So at the end of the day, I like what they did here because it raises the floor of the rotation. It gives them depth, and it gives them a veteran that truly knows how to pitch. Now, it's weird saying that because he's never thrown a pitch in Major League Baseball, but everything he's shown in the second best professional league in the world, that he's a guy who knows how to take the ball every 5 or 6 days and give you a chance to win. And it's something different than we've seen from the Orioles. I mean, they haven't brought a player over from Japan and had him actually pitch in the big leagues since they brought over Koji Uehara back in 2008. So it's been a while since the Orioles have done something like this and had it work out. So I'm just more intrigued to see maybe what he does and also what this leads to for the Orioles, maybe getting back into the Asian market a little bit more, which would certainly help them. And I think the best case comparison for him has been Hiroki Kuroda, who came over around this age, I believe, when he came to the U.S. I'm looking at it now. Yeah, when he came to the Dodgers in 2008, he was 33. So somewhat similar. He had a very successful career in Japan. And he came over at 33, and he pitched for 7 seasons. And he never had an ERA that even hit 4. And he pitched until he was 39 years old for the Yankees. So if Sugata could do something like that, and he was kind of a similar-ish pitcher to Kuroda, like, maybe this is more than 1 year. Maybe they can string him along for longer than that. And at that point, the Orioles look like geniuses. But right now, I do think it just kind of raises the floor. And that's always nice. And you know what that doesn't do? Get the fans super excited. It's not the big, sexy move. But every move that makes you better, I think, is a good move in the offseason. That's what the Orioles, at least I think, did here. Again, never thrown a pitch in MLB, so you just don't know. But signs are pointing to this at least helping them win baseball games.
I 100% believe that 2020 is a wash on any decisions that would logically normally make sense in the offseason. Because on top of what you said, you know, it's all COVID related, but because the entire world was on this lockdown and no stadium had a single fan in their seat, you're 100% relying on TV revenue, which is on its way out at that point. Everything's moving to streaming services, and we're starting to see the effect of that. Now you have major teams that don't even have a home right now. I'm going to put a sidebar out there with the Diamondbacks, because they don't seem to give a shit. They are signing whoever they want, and they don't have an RSN. So I like that, because that takes away this excuse for teams not picking up players. But COVID 100%. You literally don't know what's going to happen in the game. You literally don't know when you can open your doors again. You don't know if you have that money to sign somebody for $13 million, $10 million, whatever you want from an international perspective. But also, I have no idea what the steps and headache it had to have been to get somebody sponsored and moved to the U.S. from Japan during that time. So I hold nothing against any organizations, against Orioles, against anybody, or even against Sugano himself for 2020 just being like, I'll stick it out because I'm doing good here. I'm a star. People love me. I'm still feeling good. I'm okay with that. Him coming over now, I think it's perfectly fine. He's established himself. He's probably going to make the Hall of Fame over in the MPB, I would think, based off his award stacking list. And maybe he can perform and do something here. And ironically, the international, I guess, free agent market for Japan and even Korea is getting way more popular all of a sudden. I don't know if it's just me. Just, you know, when you start looking something up and go through rabbit hole, next thing you know, that's everything you see online. Maybe that's what's happening to me. But ever since Shohei, like, the talks of the MPB, the talks of even the KBO has been shooting up. And I want to get to something here in a second, but I wanted, which has to do with the KBO, because I think I read something earlier. Actually, I was watching one of your episodes the other day, and we'll get to Kyle Hart in a little bit. But I wanted to bring up the fact that I don't understand why at this moment in time, we haven't heard a single thing, at least I haven't, this is from my perspective, about the Orioles being in on Roki Sasaki. Because I feel like they've established themselves to go talk to him and be like, hey, like, we now have a spokesperson. Now I understand Roki Sasaki said, or his agent, who is annoying me already this offseason by saying multiple things and changing his narrative of how this is all going to work. By saying, like, don't bring your players out to discussions. Like, we don't want to meet. We're just going to have individual discussions. Don't bring the players in there to talk them into it. But you just brought on Sugano. Obviously, played against him multiple times in the recent years. Out of all the teams that are on this list and named for meetings and all this stuff, am I missing something, or are the Orioles just really not considering that option, given that who's your number five, Suarez right now?
Yes. Albert Suarez or Cade Povich right now would be the number five starter.
Is that, wouldn't it be ideal to at least try for a minor league contract deal of Roki Sasaki at this point, especially with Orioles market and budget, which I don't even know what that is anymore, because I thought new ownership was going to go crazy.
Yeah, I mean, the reporting from, was yesterday or 2 days ago, was 20 teams sent in a proposal, basically a pitch to him, and he's going to meet with 10 at the most. I think we know of 7 or 8 that he's met with of the 10. Maybe we have that full list. It seems like, from what's going on here, is that the Orioles sent a proposal and did not get a meeting. And as unfortunate as that is, there are parts of that conversation that makes some sense, right? You have the Orioles not being, and I know that Joel Wolf, his agent, has talked a lot about, you know, he's not going to prefer necessarily the biggest market. He's not going to prefer necessarily some of the same things that Japanese players have. And some of it is he's in a very different scenario. He's coming over as an international amateur. He's got a limit on what he's going to make. It's not going to be a Yamamoto deal, him getting 12 years, 300 plus million. Like, it's going to be very, very different what this looks like. We know the big teams, the Yankees, the Red Sox, the Mets, those teams got the meetings. Obviously, it looks like the Giants did, and the Dodgers did, and the Padres did. You know, your team's on the West Coast. I just think that it's also so much easier to just be on the West Coast as a player coming from Asia. And I don't know, they talked a lot about him wanting to be with a team that, you know, their pitch for how they can make him better in their pitching development. It's something the Orioles have really improved on over the past couple of years, and they've shown the results on the field. It's also an East Coast team that's not in a giant market on the East Coast, and it is not, you know, a top 10 most glamorous city to live in Major League Baseball, and these are all kind of things that come over here. And And I do think what's interesting is on one side, you would say, hey, the Orioles should have a better chance than usual because really every team should have a chance because his earning on his deal is capped. Like he's not going to make more than probably $7 or $8 million on this signing bonus, what he gets out of somebody's international pool. But on the flip side, it's like maybe the soft things actually are making a bigger difference in this process than they are for other free agents because he knows, hey, I'm going to get somewhere between $4 and $7 million in my signing bonus. One day I'm going to make hundreds of millions. Am I really that pressed between $5 or $7 million if I like this city and this organization better? On one side, you would think maybe that really helps the Orioles. Like they make this great pitch. We can give you $6 million. We can do all these things. And boom, he's in Baltimore. On the flip side, it's like maybe the Orioles as an organization, maybe Baltimore as a city doesn't have the precise things that Roky Sasaki is looking for. And that unfortunately just immediately knocks you out of the running, no matter how good your pitch is and how good your team is, because he can be so specific. Like this is Corbin Burnes on steroids. Like Corbin Burnes picked out going to Arizona because his family is there. The Diamondbacks, though, still had to offer him a competitive offer. The Diamondbacks could have said, sorry, Corbin, we have no room in our budget. We can only offer you 2 years,
for 6 years.
Yeah. We can only offer you 2 years, $50 million. Like that's all we've got. Take it or leave it. And he's like, sorry, I have such better deals. This is just not worth it for me. But the D-backs said, you know what? We can go over $200 million. And Corbin said, where do I sign? For Sasaki, he can pick out where he wants to go, but every team has the money in their budget because it's just coming out of that international pool and not out of what they've earmarked to pay their free agents, pay their major league roster. So Sasaki could have decided a year ago where he wants to play. And theoretically, he's probably hearing pitches from a couple of teams. And I'm sure the Dodgers and the Padres are 1 and 2 in this conversation. But if he said 6 months ago, I would really love to be teammates with Yu Darvish. Apparently, Yu has been some sort of a mentor to Roky Sasaki. The Padres are a good team that are in the playoffs. They're on the West Coast. And I want to play with Yu Darvish. If he goes and says that to the Padres, it doesn't matter what their budget situation is right now because of where that money's coming from. So it's really two-sided where on one hand, you're like, the Orioles should have a better chance at him than any other free agent pitcher out there. And on the other side, it's like, wait, this is the only pitcher where all 30 teams are involved. Whereas Corbin Burnes, by the end, it was Diamondbacks, Red Sox, Giants, Orioles, maybe Mets. And that's like stretching the list, right, by the end. For Sasaki, I'm sure he looked at the Rockies and was like, I'm good. But in theory, all 30 teams are in this conversation. So your slice of the pie just becomes smaller. Now, the Orioles had, a leg up over teams like the Rockies and the Pirates and, you know, some teams that have not won any baseball games recently. They were probably certainly in the top 20 of 30, I would think. But after that, it becomes really tough to know because this is the most, it's just what the player wants free agency situation of all time. And it gives you a little hope that Shohei signed with the Angels, but the Angels are on the West Coast. So that gives them that one little upage. And I do think he'll end up in San Diego when it's all said and done. I would like to know how this process played out for the Orioles. Now, again, 20 teams sent pitches. The Orioles better have been one of those teams. If the Orioles did not even send in a pitch, like, what are we doing here? I have to assume that the Orioles were one of the 20 teams that sent out a pitch. Beyond that, it's kind of up to what Roky wants, and we just don't know truly what that is at this point because we haven't heard from him. We've heard from his agent. We haven't heard from him. We may not know until he actually signs and has that press conference.
And that's something that I'm a little bit – I'm going to be honest with you. I wasn't sure if you're going to be like, oh, there's some news of – you know, there possibly was a meeting or just they're not, it's not being public about it. Because I personally think that Wolf, his agent, is just full of it. I really do. I think he's trying to play the Boris card. He's trying to push teams to think some way and then go a different route. Because you think about it, we've really only heard, like, what the Dodgers and Padres are really the top two. And then out of nowhere, there was like, the White Sox are having a meeting. And then yesterday or today, they're like, White Sox are out. Like, they're no longer part of the discussion. It's like the White Sox? Like, okay, I understand, like, they have good prospects coming up through their system because they trade all of their players for prospects. That's, I mean, just not a really good team. But I don't truly believe the White Sox have a great development system. I mean, this is just coming from what I've seen in interviews for, like, Tommy Pham, who's openly said, like, our practices are BS. Like, our trainings are just, like, they're lackadaisical. There's no, it doesn't feel serious compared to where he's played. He's played a lot of different teams and organizations, so kind of I trust him on that market in that realm. But the reason why I just don't believe it, and I know you mentioned 7 out of 10 teams were probably announced. I bet you one of those three has got to be the Orioles, because I bet you another one of those three are probably the Mariners, because they said from the start Roky Sasaki is the primary, like the main one we're going after. Now, if that's a ruse to just hold off because they haven't done a single thing, which I forgot to post. I post every single day they do nothing, and I believe 59 days since the offseason as of today. So I honestly think that the teams that haven't been announced are serious contenders in this and showing, in a way, this is my personal opinion, of, hey, we don't need to talk about this. We don't need to tell everybody that we're having this meeting, we're negotiating, we're here's our pitch. We don't need to make a big deal about it. This is what we have to offer. Are you interested? What are you looking for? How can we help? Because I think that's a better approach versus like, oh, we're in on them. Like, yeah, we're going to get them. Fans get hyped up, because I feel like that is the opposite of what Wolf claimed originally, which I think was true. Small market, less attention on the media side that attack him and be rough on his mental health, which I guess I don't have a lot of empathy, because I feel like if you're a star and this is your dream, you should be a little bit prepared for, you know, the things that follow it. I put myself in this position going, you know, online and talking about ball, and I get comments through the roof that are not exactly nicest, and that's fine. But you're a superstar, and you should be expected, if you want to go to the MLB, that you're going to get a lot of press when you are the number one focus of an offseason. And when all the meetings, like you mentioned, are the Yankees, the Mets, the Dodgers, the Padres, it's like, okay, well, that's not small market at all. I don't even think the Rangers were part of that discussion, who are very small. Like, they have, like, the fifth largest, I think, media, like sports media outlet in the country. So I think we're getting gaslit a little bit as far as the whole Roky Sasaki thing. I just wasn't sure if there was any like interest that's being spun around talked throughout the Orioles fan base of like, we should get him, or if they're just like, nah, let's go get another bat or let's do something else. Cause honestly, I would think that pitching right now after losing Corbin Burnes, there's still a little bit more that could be done there in the rotation wise, even though you guys have good pitchers. I mean, I don't have any issue with your number five, but if you could upgrade it and for cheap, I would go full on after him. But that's me personally.
Oh yeah. There's interest. There's interest from the Orioles. There's interest from the fans. It's just kind of up to Roky at this point. And again, I do believe they're one of those 20 teams that sent one of those pitches. And the other part is, you know, Roky went back to Japan. He took the meetings in California at the agency's headquarters, and then he went back to Japan for the holidays. And, you know, he's not going to sign until January 15th, because that's when the new year of the international bonus pool money flips over and he can make a little bit more money. There's no saying he won't take more meetings between now and the 15th. Like, there's no saying he won't come back to the States in the next couple of days and take some more meetings. And it's interesting too, because the latest reporting that came out like late last week was you were hearing from teams like the Tigers and the Red Sox and others who were kind of saying, hey, we made our pitch, that they like confirmed, hey, we were one of the 20 teams that made a pitch. We still haven't heard back whether or not Roky is going to meet with us or not. So maybe that's changed since that, I think that report was from last Friday. So maybe that's changed, but you still have some teams that kind of feel like they're in the balance. So maybe he will come back and he'll meet with some other teams. I mean, it can't hurt. You know, if 20 teams are making a pitch and you have the time, I think the reporting was he was keeping every meeting to 2 hours or less to try and like keep it equal. So if you have the time and he's able to meet with five or six more teams, he might do it. And hopefully one of those is the Orioles. But at this point, we kind of just don't know. And it's up to what Sasaki wants. And I mean, he's earned it with what he's done in Japan and the fact that he's that young and he's, you know, kind of forced his way out to be able to come over here. And we also talked about the media thing. Like, I think some of that for Sasaki was his want to come to MLB was not treated like Otani's want to come to MLB. And some of that was from Roky's own team. Like, Otani, when he decided to stay in Japan as a teenager and go to NPB, he had an agreement with his team and his contract that basically said, when I feel I'm ready, I'm going to MLB. And he just went. And Roki wanted to do the same thing, but apparently didn't have those same kind of things in his contract, and the team wasn't willing to give it to him, so he kind of had to fight it out. Like, he clearly is ready, the stuff, what he's done, and he wanted to fight it out and go to MLB. And he, there were some reports that he wanted to go last offseason. His team just basically said, we're not posting you, we're not letting you. And so that frustrated him throughout this year. And I think a lot of the Japanese media that covered his team specifically, it sounds like, kind of took the team side in this, and that seemingly is what has frustrated him. And now it's a different media environment here than it is in Japan, who will also have a lot of Japanese reporters following him in the same way that Ohtani did when he first came over, and still does at this point since signing with the Dodgers. But I think that's where a lot of that stemmed from. And it's definitely interesting, because I think, at least with some teams, some markets here, I think Sasaki's side of it would be seen a little differently than it is. Now, there's not really MLB players who are like, hey, I'm good enough, I want to go to another baseball league, because this is the league you're trying to go to. Yeah. So that doesn't really come up with major league teams too often. It's closer to, you know, a player demanding a trade, and, you know, how does that get played out and reported on by the local reporters, by the national reporters. But that was reporting too. And again, it's all kind of conjecture, because we haven't heard from Roki. And until we do, and Chad, I can't imagine we hear from him until he signs. Like, I don't see any scenario where he talks before he signs. And as much as you can hear from Joel Wolf, like, even if he's telling the full truth of everything and what Roki's telling him, you're just not going to know it for sure until you hear from Sasaki. And at that point, it's going to be too late, right? He's going to be signing a contract and doing his opening press conference. So I'm just really intrigued to see where he signs and kind of hear from him on what went into that decision. And it does seem like, I think one good thing that'll come out of this is, whatever you may think about Joel Wolf, like, he seems to be pretty open to talking with the media. So I do think when this is all said and done, we'll probably get a couple of good stories on, like, the inside of the Roki Sasaki recruitment by all these teams. And I'm kind of excited to read that story whenever it comes out, to see how this process really went down. Because the last time something like this happened was Shohei Ohtani, and it was just a madhouse of every team being like, this could be the greatest player ever, we need to go get him, and all these different pitches they're doing. It's something close to this with Sasaki, and I'm intrigued to see, like, what this process looks like on the inside.
So far, Ohtani's been, I mean, as of right now, if he sustains what he's doing, I don't see a reason why they were wrong. I mean, Angels came up big, and I think they blew it. Angels fans don't like me for a couple videos I put out, but that is a royal mistake, for if I'm putting it lightly, for how they handled Ohtani. Whether or not you're going to extend him or not, which they didn't have the money for, obviously, but to just let him go to free agency, what? You could have one-soded him. You know, you could have gotten so much back, and the Angels could be. But I mean, as a Mariner fan, like, okay, that's fine with me. But I still would like to see a team better themselves if they know that they can't, you know, if they can't afford the player that they brought on, who is a generational hitter and pitcher. You know what I mean? Like, the first time we've seen a Babe Ruth-esque player ever, really, like, at this level since Babe Ruth. So, yeah, and with Roki just being a pitcher, I don't see why he can't be equivalent as a pitcher as Shohei was a hitter this year. Because we all know the buzz. I mean, even in the playoffs, all we saw was like, 4 more batters till Ohtani's up. 7 more batters till Ohtani's up. Like, hey, 3 more days before Roki's pitching. You know, there's definitely a ton of media attention coming from Japan now because of Ohtani. And like you were saying, like, it would be interesting where he ends up. Now, I live relatively close to San Diego before I moved to Seattle. And it's the Padres are – I'm a fan. I do like that team. Granted, I would much rather see him in Seattle. But at the same time, I would say that – I think Seattle really needs to pivot, because they've done nothing, and they need offense. Their pitching is very good, and it's fine and dandy as long as you keep it there. But they need bats, and that's dwindling away as we go, to where the Orioles, you have hitting. You really do. I mean, you have great left-handed bats. I'm hoping Jackson Holliday wakes up a little bit. He started to kind of see a tiny bit of a spark towards the end, but what a rough beginning it was for him. I hope that he can live up to the hype, especially next year, and especially since I'm assuming he's going to be starting at second. I don't see any reason why not. But you guys do have a plethora of infielders, which trades? Like, I think you put out a couple lineups for next season that you predict that would most likely be reasonable if everything stayed as is. And, I mean, you have O'Hearn and Mountcastle basically platooning DH in first, except for right-handed pitchers. Is that right?
I mean, it's a big question on what they do with Ryan Mountcastle. And you mentioned trades. Like, he's got to be the number one guy up there that they're looking to move. They were looking to move him at the deadline. I think they're still looking to move him now because he's just not quite fitting in what they want to do with this roster anymore. And he's certainly tailed off from his production earlier in his career. And he's not a guy who I think you can move one for one and get a legit piece back, but he's a guy who can throw in there to be a major league quality bat for another team with other players to get something. And I just think if he's on this team, is it worth platooning at first base? I don't know. Like he maybe he'll play almost every day, but I think they have some better options potentially. So it's almost like if you want a platoon, you want to do it for guys who can at least play defense. And he's a good defensive first baseman, but it's first base. You know, he's not super versatile on the roster anywhere else. Platooning a first baseman is it's kind of tough. You don't see teams do it a whole lot. I think like the Brewers are the only team that did it last year, and that's because they just can't find a first baseman to save their life, even though they did bring in Rhys Hoskins, and he still wasn't that good when they brought him in. So it's not something teams do, and I think they might be looking to move Mountcastle. And I don't know, maybe that's someone Seattle's interested in. Obviously, you're not making a Mountcastle for a starter in Seattle trade. Obviously, there has to be a lot more coming from the Orioles end there, but he's a bat. It's just I know right-handed bats in Seattle have not exactly had their way, not named Julio Rodriguez, over the past few years. So it's certainly a push and pull with Mountcastle. But, yeah, you know, they have the DH first base kind of mixed with those two and Heston Kerstad, and they got a lot of hitters. Like, they are – I feel good about their lineup right now, even though maybe it takes a half step back losing Santander. You get a better Holiday and a better Kerstad and a bounce back from Adley Rutschman and probably a better Kobe Mayo getting in the mix there. I feel pretty good about where the lineup kind of sits right now for the O's.
Do you think that helped that left field – I mean, we're bringing it right back to the left field fence being moved. I mean, Mountcastle is a righty as far as – unless I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure he's a righty. You think that played a factor the last couple of years? Because it seems like his numbers in the last years have been rough. Not before that, though.
Yeah, I mean, he had the 30-plus homer season in 2021, which is the last year they had the shorter wall before they moved it back. And he, you know, it's interesting to think about because you would say, oh, this is really going to hurt righties. And it definitely hurts righty power. But on the flip side, there's a lot more room out there. So there's more room for singles and doubles and triples for right-handers to kind of smoke one into the gap. Mountcastle just stopped pulling the ball altogether. Like, he had the lowest pull rate of any right-handed hitter last year. And you got to think the wall, he's staring at that wall in left field in 81 of his games. You have to think that plays a factor. And so I think it messed with his head a lot. That was the number one thing Mike Elias cited when he did the press conference announcing that they were moving the wall back in. He didn't talk as much about, hey, we want to get more free agents or pitchers or hitters or whatever it may be. He talked about the guys on his own roster, and it became too much of a distraction for the Orioles' own guys. And that is why, and every Orioles fan read the tea leaves and said, he is speaking directly to Ryan Mountcastle. I do think that moving the wall in makes it more likely they stay with him and don't deal. Like, if they were going into next year with this same wall, they'd be doing everything in their power to trade Ryan Mountcastle right now. He becomes more valuable with that wall coming back in. But so does Kobe Mayo, who's completely ready to take his spot as the right-handed power-hitting corner infielder. And so in that case, you could say, oh, it just helps Mayo more. Maybe we're more likely for him to have a breakout season. Then we're right back to we feel okay with trading Ryan Mountcastle. That's kind of where they're at with him.
Yeah, because, I mean, you mentioned, especially if Mayo's ready. You mentioned in one of your recent videos, you know, Kobe Mayo most likely starting in AAA, which I think at this point, that guy is ready to go. Like, I'm pretty sure the Mariners already made an offer for him. I'm probably pretty confident there's a few other teams that made an offer for him and were in trade discussions for Kobe Mayo. But given that Mountcastle has had these rough years, and when I was looking into Mountcastle, that was the first thing that I thought about was that the wall move, and then exactly what you said, hitting Oppo last year. Like, I think he changed his approach because it's just like, this is not working. Like, there's no pull. There's no reason for you to pull the ball unless you're going to be able to hit in the gaps, and they're just not landing. So if they were to move him, I feel like the value is low, which is unfortunate for Mountcastle, but you are going to get something back. And I mean, you do have so many infielders, and a team like the Mariners is a team that needs more than just first base. They need more than just second base. They need more than just third base. You know, they need more bullpen guys. So it can be, I think, a situation where it's like, okay, do you guys really want to keep Emmanuel Rivera? Because I like him. I think he did good for the time they did play in Baltimore. I understand you guys have Westberg, and I know that's the dream guy, but you guys aren't going to let him go at all. He's basically, in a way, he's like your Julio Rodriguez to us. He's your young guy who has just kicked it off, and he has a really good bat. He's good defensive. You want to hang on to him for sure. Makes sense. And he's cheap, especially for now. But, I mean, who's disposable at this point? Because you have so many guys. Are you ready to move Kobe up? Get rid of Mountcastle. What about Rivera? Or would you rather have him be your backup third base in case something happens to Westberg? He was injured last year, right?
Yeah, Westberg missed 2 months with a broken hand last year, and they really struggled without him in the lineup. Yeah. I mean, in terms of guys that I think they'd be willing to move from the hitting perspective, I think Mountcastle's still number one on that list. Now, this is not a ranking of value. This is just a ranking of most willing to move. After that, it kind of gets convoluted. Like, the Orioles are like, right now, Emmanuel Rivera does not have a place on the roster. So if a team wants to come and get him, they could have him for almost nothing.
His bat, they're gonna get DFA'd, right?
Yeah, but probably, yeah, unless there's injuries, he's still around. They tendered him a contract for $1 million. He's still around in case somebody else gets injured in spring training. He can fill in as the kind of backup infielder. But he's kind of just around for that. He'll probably get DFA'd before the season starts. But after Mountcastle, you've got some pieces who I think they'd be willing to move for the right price. Now, you do have guys like Jorge Mateo and Ramon Arias. Those are also kind of utility infielders. I don't know if the Mariners want to go down the Arias path again, just with the, surprisingly at this point, the more productive brother, Ramon.
His brother's terrible. My God.
And Luis was the one who was the top prospect. Ramon was playing in the Mexican League while Luis was the top prospect. All of a sudden, it's 2025, and it is no question Ramon is the better major league player than Luis is, which is kind of surprising. But
I think Luis performed well in Boston, having that wall. That was his big thing. He's basically like an Isak Paredes.
I mean, yeah, just without the talent level that Isak has, but yeah.
Yes, yes, and his weird little lean back. I couldn't stand the way his batting stance, but.
But, you know, if they wanted Jorge Mateo, they wanted Ramon Arias, like, those guys are obviously available. But I think that the bigger names that I think Seattle would be looking for are a little bit younger, a little bit more so guys that they feel could be everyday regulars. Like, Arias could be a regular. Mateo, probably not. Rivera, probably not. But you're looking at Mountcastle. He could be an everyday player, you know, if mm-hmm. he gets a little more confident, starts pulling the ball again. And then you have the two big names, young guys / prospect wise, even though they've each gotten a taste of the big leagues so far, that are tradable for the Orioles this offseason. And those are Heston Kerstad and Kobe Mayo. Now, it's going to have to be the right deal for the Orioles to part with either of those guys. And it's not going to be for a relief pitcher, right? The Orioles need to get a controllable starting pitcher. Or if it's going to be a rental starting pitcher, it's got to be the Dylan Cease level of guy who can put at the top of your rotation if you go get him. But if the Mariners are willing to move Luis Castillo, maybe the Orioles are willing to move a Kobe Mayo or a Heston Kerstad in a deal like that. Or, you know, if a team like the Padres is willing to move. I mean, the golden goose for the Orioles right now is Pablo Lopez in Minnesota. If they're looking to cut payroll, he's got 3 years left. He's been healthy. He's got good stuff. He's got good numbers. Like, I think the Orioles would be willing to move a guy like Kobe Mayo for that. And Luis Castillo may fall into that category as well, because if his option vests, you know, you have him for 4 more years. And while it's not arbitration, like, he's making real money, it's nice to know what a player's making for the next 4 years and not have to rely on extending them or going through arbitration. Like, you can set up for that cost for the next 4 years, makes them kind of easier to bring in a player if you are a little worried about long-term pitcher contracts. Maybe that's the guy. Like, the Orioles, I think, have to be willing to deal their guys. And I think they are, right? They were willing to part with DL Hall and Joey Ortiz to go get a rental Corbin Burns. Like, they knew most likely he was not going to re-sign with Baltimore after this year, and that's what happened. And I think they're willing to do a deal like that again. Just at some point, you run out of stuff to trade. If you keep trading guys for pitchers with 1 year left, like if they go and get Dylan Cease, he's got 1 year left. He's a Scott Boras client. He's not going to sign an extension. Maybe you'd have a chance to re-sign him next offseason, like they had a chance with Corbin Burns, but it seems more than likely that he would sign elsewhere, considering how the Orioles feel about long-term deals for pitchers. So can you really do that every year? Like, yeah, it'd be nice to have Corbin Burns and then Dylan Cease back-to-back years. But can you sustain an organization if your plan for an ace is just trading for a guy with 1 year remaining and then basically getting a draft pick for him when you offer him the qualifying offer and he signs elsewhere? Like, it's not really sustainable. The Orioles do think they have in either Kyle Bradish or Grayson Rodriguez a true young ace on this team, but they've both been dealing with injury stuff over the past year. So I'm so intrigued what they're going to do. I will say, if the Orioles are going to win the World Series, I think between now and the trade deadline, I think they're going to have to deal either Mayo or Kerstad, because I think those are the two players that can get them a starting pitcher that can put them over the hump. And I just don't know if this rotation right now, I think, can get them to the playoffs. I don't know if this is a World Series rotation right now.
I agree. I mean, right now, as they sit, I would say they're a solid number three, possible number two with Red Sox. Because the Red Sox signed a lot of guys, but there's also time before they come back, at least in their starting rotation. Patrick Sandoval is like a half-year guy. You're not going to see him halfway through the season. Giolito's coming back. We'll see how that how his arm handles itself. You know, I know it's going to be fully healed and stuff, but they've made upgrades to their team, but their upgrades with a lot of question marks, at least from what I can see. And of course, they're still on the talks about Alex Bregman, so we'll see what happens. But as of right now, I see if the Orioles can perform the way they did 2 years ago, or even last year, but carry that into the playoffs, then I think they're fighting number two for sure, especially right now. But I would like to see, I would think a deal for Luis Castillo would be reasonable. I'm not really on board with them getting rid of any pitching. Our starting rotation should be left alone. Our ownership should just stop being shitty, and they should just go get free agents like any other team, because it's really not that much money. We know how much money they're making, so it's very much smoke, and it's frustrating for us. For Baltimore, they're spending some money. At least they picked somebody up. They picked up two big names. One just happens to be international, but you know, versus our side, it's like, okay, if it's going to really come down to a trade, then yeah, if you guys were willing to give up Coby Mayo, we need a first baseman. I'm perfectly fine with Luke Raley at first, even though that's the secondary position, but I'd be cool with that. Of course, we need a third baseman. So third base, and then if we really are going after and grabbing Hyesung Kim, which sounds like it's already been decided by some insiders in the KBO, fine, we have our second baseman, but honestly, he's a glorified Dylan Moore. So on your guys' end, Coby Mayo would be my number one go-after guy. Not exactly Ryan Mountcastle, because I just don't trust him at T-Mobile Park. But another third baseman, so maybe I guess that would be Rivera. But at that point, it's like, I feel like that's not really enough, you know? And that might be biased on my side, but it's like, if I ask for any more, we're going to have to start including players on our end too. Because it's got to be fair, obviously, from both sides. I don't feel like there's a way to fleece either one of the teams at this point, because they're very conscious of what they have. We already saw that with how the Boston trade went through, is Masataka Yoshida and Tristan Casas for Luis Castillo, which I was okay with, but it's all about money for them. They just can't give up any money. So that killed the entire deal. Now, before we run out of time, because I know you got to get going, I wanted to hit on Kyle Hart, you mentioned, who's in the KBO, who pitched really well this last season. And nobody's talking about him, which is, I'm glad you brought him up yesterday. I think you brought him up. This would be a nice under the radar pickup, I think, for the Orioles. But I do have a lot of concerns, because the last time I saw a KBO pitcher, and I understand he's not from the KBO, but he went over there to pitch. He was elite in AAA in what, 2023, 2022, 2023, that time period, I believe. And then he went over to the KBO and he did really well, really good as well in 2024. So my question is, because in my opinion, the reason why I'm not high on, no pun intended, Hyesung Kim, is because I see KBO as being, there's single A, there's double A, there's KBO, there's triple A, there's MPB, and then there's MLB. That's how I, as far as talent level, how good he did in the KBO. The last person I saw come up, which was quite a few years ago, 2019, Hyunjin Ryu with the, well, he was with the Dodgers, then got traded to Toronto, like 10 years or something like that. And he was sporadic. First 2 years, great. Didn't play as much, I believe, injury. Played really good in 2019. And then he did nothing for another year. And then he pitched a full season and did not so good in 2021. And then played two more seasons, barely played, and then retired. Does he have the potential? Could Kyle Hart be also someone who can come up to the MLB and actually play at that level and dominate? I don't know. I think he's good. I think it would be a good person to have in your rotation or your bullpen, but is, I mean, I know it's not a great comparison, but the last time we really saw a KBO pitcher, a starting rotation pitcher, and am I getting wrong? Or are you going to think about putting him in the bullpen?
Yeah, I mean, I think the report was the Orioles were one of five teams interested, and it said a couple of the teams were interested in as a reliever, like a multi-inning guy, and a couple teams as a starter. I think since the Orioles have already gotten their back-end rotation guy in Sugano, if they were to go after Hart, it would be as a reliever who, if they feel they need to, could move him into the rotation at any point during the season, would kind of be projected as a reliever. I think the hope for whatever team gets Kyle Hart, and again, like, he only pitched in four big league games. That was with the Red Sox in 2020. He was not a super highly rated prospect. He kind of popped in double A and triple A and had really good numbers, and that's why the Red Sox gave him a shot. He changed a little bit on what he throws. It's a really good changeup. It's a solid slider. It's an okay fastball. The hope is that he would do what Eric Fetty did, which was, you know, pitch for the Nats for years and just be, I mean, Fetty was a top prospect. That's the difference between him and Hart. Fetty was a top prospect with the Nationals, came up to the big leagues. The Nats gave him chance after chance after chance, and he just didn't really put it all together. He went to KBO in 2023 with the same NC Dinos team, won the MVP over there, got a deal with the White Sox, pitched really well, got dealt to the Cardinals at the deadline. So the hope is that Hart could do that. The difference is Fetty had pitched four big league seasons. Hart had pitched four big league games. Fetty was a top prospect. Hart was a 19th round draft pick who kind of popped in AAA. Like, they're very, very different backgrounds. Now, they had very similar success in KBO. Like, Hart set the KBO strikeout record last year. That's not nothing. That's the, you know, you could, I'd say it's probably closer to AAA talent-wise, probably, but
at that level, absolutely.
Yeah, overall, I would say across the board, it's probably the third best league, because in AAA, there's just such a dichotomy of talent, whereas KBO, it's a little more centered and everybody's a little more averaged out, so I'd call it the third best league behind MLB and NPB. But the fact that you're setting strikeout records somewhere, even if you call that AAA, that's a pitcher who you'd be excited to bring up to MLB the next year. So it's still a guy who could have some success. But again, it's a 32-year-old throwing 91. So at some point, there's question marks. And I think for the Orioles, it would be start out in relief, then see what you got after that. Whereas I think for some other teams, I see Hart doing what Fetty did last year. Sign with a terrible team so you know you'll be a starter. Hope they trade you at the deadline. That's kind of what I see him doing, but maybe the Orioles are in play here.
Yeah, and I mean, like, maybe he can be your DL Hall. I mean, just older. Like, you use him as a bullpen piece, and then you can have an option for starting rotation, which I think the Brewers are doing now. I mean, I didn't really hear much about DL Hall when he went to the Brewers, but
yeah, he was injured again last year, which is kind of par for the course for him. Yeah.
Another good reason to kind of let him go. He's a lottery ticket for them. And I guess they were just trying to get rid of Corbin Burns' contract. So that was a win for you guys. It just really sucks that, you know, you weren't able to bring Burns back. So maybe there's some hope. There's a lot of pitching options, at least still. I mean, Jack Flaherty's out there, but I mean, he's been with the Orioles before. So how will he do? I don't know. With the easier left field, how will he do? I don't know. I guess we'll have to wait and see. But yeah, I mean, that's all I really got for you. I really appreciate you coming on. we're going to see what happens the rest of this offseason, and maybe we can have you back somewhere near opening day or something like that, see how things have shifted and kind of reminisce on this whole podcast and see what happens.
Maybe if there's a Orioles Mariners blockbuster trade, that's when we can do this again.
All right, man. I appreciate you coming on. And again, if you guys want to go ahead and check out his social, it'll be down in the description. Make sure you go subscribe to Lock On Orioles if you guys are interested in following that team. It is an interesting team to follow in the East because they're still playoff contenders, even as the team sits right now, and even looking at the Yankees and the Red Sox. So go check him out. He'll keep you updated on everything. You're doing three videos a week during this offseason. It'll be back to every single day when this season starts. That's correct.
That is correct. Yeah, three episodes a day. That would put me over the edge. But three a week. Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, if you can pull it off, man. Like, I more power to you. So go check him out. Go subscribe. Follow him on X. And I'll see you guys on the next one. Later.